Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Could you whisper in my ear the things you want to feel? I'll give you anything to feel it coming. Do you wake up on your own? I wonder where you are and live with all your faults. I want to wake up where you are. I won't say anything at all.
All right, it is 8 minutes after 8 here on the West Coast. 8 minutes after 11 o'clock on the East Coast. Joining me from the East Coast of America, North Carolina to be specific, Jacksonville to be even more specific, is retired Marine Corps Sergeant Major Joe Huell. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful. How are you doing today out there on the left coast?
You know what? It was nice when you were here, but before you got here, it was cold and rainy, and since you left, it's been cold and rainy, so you might need to come back.
It's cold and rainy here. I'm ready to come back.
Well, it ain't here, so stay where you're at. The Joe, I wanted to talk about, wanted to have you on. I'd never met you. I'd heard of you in my Marine Corps life, but never had a chance to meet you, and our paths crossed last week at the Marine Expo West, or the Marine West Expo, whichever you prefer. First of all, tell everybody, how were you involved in that? What were you doing out there?
I am like the company gunny, if you will, of the show. I go out early, go to the commands, meet the commanders and the senior enlisted advisors, and then get the Marines and the sailors to the show. And I also, while I'm there, I'm kind of a go-between between the civilians and the Marine Corps. If they got a problem, they come to me, and I try and get it fixed without it going, getting out of, pushed out of proportion.
So you are the company gunny?
Yes, sir. I am the company gunny.
Well,
yeah.
Well, all right. So the, and that's where we met. And we'll talk about that in a few minutes. So let's talk about you first. So the people that don't know you can get a gauge on whether they should believe anything you say or not. Born and raised where?
I was born and raised on a dairy farm in upstate New York.
Upstate New York. How does...
Little Falls, New York.
You know, we were talking...
Right at the foot of the Adirondack Mountains.
We were talking about the state of New York. If you locked... the greater New York City, New Jersey area out of New York, tell everybody, what would you have left in the state?
What would I have left in the state?
Well, what would be, if you got rid of Manhattan and New York City, right? What is, the rest of the state?
The Adirondack Mountains.
Yeah.
The Adirondack Mountains.
It's small town America, right?
Small town. I was born, like, you know, they make fun of stop town.
Right.
So that's what I have. I have a grocery store. We do have a bar and a couple of small other little restaurants. That's about it.
If you look at a map of New York, the state of New York, you look at what it's comprised of, other than the big port cities up on the Great Lakes and the Hudson, I mean, you're talking about small town America and virtually all of New York. All of New York. How did the Marine Corps get on your radar in New York? It's not, you know, it's not close to a base or anything like that.
No, it isn't. Well, I come from World War II. I had five uncles in World War II. My dad was in World War II. I had lost three uncles in World War II.
Oh, really?
And I knew right from the get-go that I was going to serve my country, but I didn't know that it was going to be a Marine. My dad was in the Army Air Corps, so I wanted to be like my dad. I wanted to join, but it wasn't longer an Air Corps. By then, it was actually Air Force.
Right.
In 1964 is when I joined.
Okay, so hold on. What did your, let's talk about your family. Your, Your father is part of the Army Air Corps. What did he do during the war?
He was a radio operator and a gunner on B-17s.
In Europe?
In Europe, yes, sir.
Holy shit, man.
Yeah, he was actually he went down twice aircraft during the war. He was gone for a long, long time. Never would talk about his experience when I grew up. He never would talk about his experience until I come back to Vietnam.
And then he started talking because he thought you could understand?
I guess I'd been there and done that, so I kind of understood some of the things that he was talking about, what he went through as a young airman. He was a staff sergeant in our Air Corps.
Yeah, all of staff sergeant all at the age of 21, right? Something like that.
At the age of 21, yes, sir. Yeah,
21.
Yeah.
George, you watch what those guys did. They got in those machines and on a daily basis, they went up in the skies over Germany, and went on those bombing runs, and the B-17s. I don't want to say you were sitting ducks, but you essentially got into this gigantic formation, and you,
yep.
You fought off the Messerschmitts that came up after you. You hope the flak didn't find your altitude, but you drove in this big box formation over Germany, cut it all loose, and then you drove home. So he got shot down twice?
His aircraft went down twice.
And he never was captured either time?
He was never captured. They made it back to a safe landing both times.
Oh, okay.
He did tell me he did lose all his hair. I mean, when he joined the Air Corps, he had red hair, and when I was born, I had black hair. I don't know how that happens. I have no idea. I'm not even.
Well, tell me about, you said you had three uncles that were killed in World War II. Where were they serving, and where were they killed?
They were in Europe. They were in Europe. One of them went to become, and he was found later. But they were killed in battles. I don't know all the history of them. Okay. I know one of them was kind of a CIA undercover over there, and I had an uncle that was in the Navy. He was in the ships. He was at Pearl Harbor. My dad was at Pearl Harbor, but he was in the barracks at Pearl Harbor when it happened. He wasn't flying, but my uncle was on one of the ships. Uncle Bert was on a ship in Hawaii when he got bombed.
Holy smokes! They got all over the place. Your uncles? How? Wow!
They did. Yep. And yeah. God love my grandma.
No kidding.
She become a very big part of my life later on, and we can get to that if you'd like later in this talk when I come back from Vietnam.
How did all of that affect her, Joe?
Her?
Yes.
Oh my God! Yeah, she was. She was true American. I mean, it hurt her, but she like a lot of American moms today, and not so many moms today. Moms back then that they were there for a purpose, and they were serving their country. She loved them every bit of it.
Yeah.
And when I got ready to join the service of the Marine Corps, and I was. I had a cousin that was ahead of me, who's in Korea, but which I never knew after I joined the Marine Corps. But she never tried to talk me out of it or anything until later on after I ended. But when I first said, "Hey, I'm joining the service," I mean, she says, "Hey, you got to serve your country."
Wow, and those words couldn't come easy because, she received, and back then, hell, all she got was a telegram, right?
That's all she got. And it was later on. It was months she went without knowing until, it was come across her and my mom and stuff, yeah.
So you have all this history in your family. Your dad's part of the Army Air Corps, now the United States Air Force, and you start looking at branches of the service to join. You don't have any connection to the Marine Corps.
None whatsoever. And what happened was that my dad came downhill when we was on. I was 16, I quit school to run the farm. And after I turned 17, I was 17 and a half, my dad got rid of the farm because it was way too much. And I went to work in a sawmill as a lumberjack. And one day I was talking, I said, oh, I'm gonna join the service. And so I went to the Air Force and went down, I passed the test, but in 1964, even they were not taking high school grad. They were, unless you were a high school graduate, they weren't taking it. So he told his buddy, and he said his Marine buddy, he said, "Hey, I got a lucky one here for you. You need to stop up there in Dallas, New York, and see this this young cool guy." And so he did. He showed up at the store and talked to me. Still wasn't convinced. I didn't know that much about the Marine Corps, really, because I really didn't back then. Wasn't thinking about it. I worked the next day, and my cousin, I was telling my cousin that, look, I had this Marine recruiter at the house yesterday. Sounded like a pretty good thing to join the Marine Corps. And he said, "I'll bet you $50 you ain't bad enough." Okay. I never did collect my $50.
So you won the veteran and never collected.
Yeah, but that's how I got in the Marine Corps. That's how on March 23rd, 1964, I put my feet on the yellow foot press island.
Now, had the Ribbon Creek incident happened yet?
Oh yes, that was over. Yeah, that had to happen. Yep.
I did a really, really interesting. I did two interviews with him, but he's a guy who was at Paris Island at the time of the incident, although it wasn't part of that series. His last name is Stevens, and he wrote a book about Ribbon Creek. And I have to tell you that, like a lot of things I wind up reading about, it wasn't anything like what I thought it was. You know, when I actually kind of dug into it and read about it, it wasn't anything close to what I had thought it was going to be. It's very interesting, very interesting, very interesting study. But and he actually interviewed the gunnery sergeant that I can't remember his name, that was involved in the incident. But it was very, very interesting. And then General Poehler. His name is John Stevens. He was wound up getting out of the Marine Corps as a corporal and was at Paris Island. And so the book is titled Court Martial at Paris Island, The Ribbon Creek Incident by John Stevens III. And they're really fascinating interviews about the incident. But anyway, let's talk about your career. So how do you become – were you a grunt when you came in?
I was. I was an old – when I got out of boot camp, when I got to Tiger, I was an 0351, and my uncle and his two daughters had drowned in my hometown. Oh, I was at camp when I was at ITR, and I went home to leave to the funeral. And when I come back, we were in formation, and the company gunny standing out there, and he says, we got some changes in MOSs, and I need 0311s. And, he went down and started calling off names, and Joe Hool's name was one of them. So I become a rifleman real quick, and, went on to, I joined my unit, in the Marine Corps. It was, Golf Company 2-Whip. It was an awesome, America's, it was awesome.
All right, so talk to me about at what point do you decide that so you're in the Marine Corps, you're living the glorious life of an 0311 at Camp Lejeune, and when do you decide to make it a career and why?
Well,
wait, so what year is that?
1964. I got the Camp Lejeune in 1964. Went to state, made a couple of deployments. I come back from off my, the last, we were in Cuba, Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, and we come home from that, and, I had ordered to Camp Perry, Ohio. I was a corporal. I got promoted to corporal, April Fool's Day, 1966, in Guantanamo Bay. And I come home, got back to Camp Lejeune, had ordered, they were sending me to Camp Perry, Ohio, to be a scorekeeper at the matches, the big division
right,
matches.
Right.
And, so I went home on leave, and, I ended up getting married when I went home on leave.
What?
I had no, June 4th, 1966, I got married, and I come back to Camp Lejeune to pick up my orders to go to Camp Perry, Ohio, knowing I was going to take my wife. And, she was going to meet me at Camp Bay, Ohio for whatever long, and then down to Camp Lejeune, and we were going to have the year after. Well, when I got back to Camp Lejeune, First Sergeant Bess, said, come in here, Hoss. your orders have been changed. At the time, I was the company commander's of radio operator as a corporal.
Oh, so you must be a smart guy.
And anyway, he called me in his office and he says, your order has been changed, pack your shit, you're leaving, this afternoon. You and a number of others are going, you're going to Camp Pendleton to stage in battalion. You're on your way to Vietnam. So, we packed up our stuff. Of course, it's not like today. If you didn't own it, it didn't go into sea bag. that's all you had is this one sea bag, and then you didn't have a duffel bag, you didn't have a backpack, you just had a sea bag. So everything went in sea bag, and we flew out to staging battalion, and I called my new wife from Camp Pendleton, and she said that she said, you sound like you're so far away. I said, I am. I'm at Camp Pendleton. What are you doing at Camp Pendleton? And I told her I'm on my way to Vietnam. And, of course, tears come out and all this. But, so then I didn't get to see her. I ended up going, do staging battalion, went to Vietnam, joined up, my company, 3rd Battalion, 1st Marines, in Vietnam in, August of, matter of fact, just after my 21st birthday, in Vietnam. I was in Vietnam 48 hours, and I was in my very first firefight.
Congratulations. So you never did have to kind of go campaign for your combat action ribbon. Good for you.
No, I didn't. I got there. As a matter of fact, when I checked into the first sergeant sent me straight to the platoon, got out there, met up with Lieutenant Sisko. God love him, lost his legs later on. But, he said that, Corporal Hull, you're the first squad leader. And I said, I think you've been a country, hours here. There's gotta be other people. And he said, no, you're gonna relieve Lance Corporal, so I can't remember his name. He was actually the first squad leader. It was as a Lance Corporal. He'd been wounded a couple times already himself. The next day, I'm in a firefight. My first one got indoctrinated real quick.
Okay. So, Joe, tell everybody, so this is what, 1966 now?
1966 now, yes, sir.
Okay, so 1966, and what part of Vietnam?
I was south of Marble Mountain. We were down in the sand flats south of Marble Mountain.
All right, and you guys are mostly fighting Viet Cong down there, or
we were doing search and destroy missions.
Got it. Give me one of the first combat leadership lessons you ever learned.
The first combat leadership lesson I ever learned was what Jesse Puller had told us, told the Marine Corps, the less you bleed more. The more you sweat and pee, the better you bleed more. And it was my very first firefight, and it was all over with. My squad kind of was laughing and joking because I adrenaline had kicked in, and not to be vulgar or anything, but I urinated all over myself.
Right.
My very first firefight. But they were joking. They said, Corporal Holy said, you know, you did everything as if you were a politician. This is not your very first firefight. And I said, yes, it was. But it was only because of the training that I had received prior to going that it become automatic during the firefight, the very first firefight. So I believed in, you know, the training. If you're gonna mess around in a training environment, that's what's gonna happen in a combat zone, if somebody's gonna get killed. And that was my very first lesson.
Interesting, because you try to talk to people about that, and especially when you talk about discipline, and you say,
yes, sir.
And you say, you know, nobody's gonna fairy dust you on the flight over.
That's right.
Either you're gonna be disciplined, and you're going to be tough and hard to kill, or if you're not, you're going to pay. You're going to pay in lives and limbs and all kinds of stuff. And so discipline is your friend. You got to embrace it.
Yeah.
But it's interesting the reaction you get to that from people like, yeah, we got it. We know what's going on. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So then we moved on. And first part of October, I think it was October 6th or 7th, we were on a search and destroy mission. I'm a corporal, and I only got 7 Marines in my squad.
Right.
That's it. I have a corpsman, 7 Marines in a squad, and I have a machine gun attached to me, to my squad. And we sit in around the village in the evening. The next morning, just as the daylight, the Viet Cong that was in the village decided that they were going to break out of the village in Corporal Hull's position. And, all heck broke loose. I mean, the firefighting took off, and, I heard, Corman up, and Corman was in the fighting hole next to me, and he got up and went to the machine gun position. And my A-gunner took a round and shot it. I left my position, got into the machine gun position, and to become the A-gunner. And then the firefighter stopped. It was almost like you turn a radio on for a minute and a half and then turn it off.
Right.
And it was over. I turned to see how the A-gunner, because the doctor had him all patched up and he was sitting there, and I turned and my machine gunner said, "Dang, Corporal Hull, you've been hit." And at the time, I took a piece of shrapnel in my left shoulder, and I didn't even know it. But after he told me that I'd been hit, then it hurt like the devil. I didn't even know I got hit by a piece of shrapnel. I got had a nice little hole in my left shoulder by a piece of shrapnel.
Talk to me about, so you, like everybody else, Joe, you spent probably a year there, or
18 months. 18 months I spent there.
So
yep.
you extended?
I did extend. I ended up getting wounded twice more.
Okay.
But I did extend, because of an exercise. We were short-handed and we had a big exercise coming on, so I stayed for, another 6 months. I ended up getting R&R. I got R&R twice. I was so fortunate. The first one, I put in for R&R and, sent a letter home to my new bride. Took it, I'm going to get R&R to Hawaii, so take the money that you're getting and buy a ticket and, meet me at this time in R&R. Well, about a week or so prior to my R&R, it got canceled. we got on the radio, the ham radio. That's all we had is when you called home, that was, right. You had to talk by the ham radio over. And I got up with her and told her that my R&R had been canceled, and she was not too thrilled. And that, we'll try and make it up later. I'll try and get in more in question. 3 seconds or 3 minutes or whatever it was on the ham radio when it's over. And anyway, the day that I was supposed to go on R&R, first sergeant came in to me, Jackson, first sergeant Jackson came in and said, get your stuff, you're going on R&R. We don't have texting and radios and phones like we have today. I mean, there was no way that I could get up with my bride, Alice, and tell her that I'm going. And I wasn't about to turn it down. If I could get out of country for 2 days, I'm getting out of this place. So I got to Hawaii and I called her from Hawaii and, she had spent the money for the airfare. So I spent a week in Hawaii the first time by myself.
How was it? But I mean,
it was a good R&R. I mean, I drank a lot and got down to the beach, got relaxed, and there was a few other Marines there that was in the same boat about. So we had a good time.
Right.
I got to see Hawaii quite a bit, and I got to see my corpsman fiance and her family. So I got to eat home cooked meals and stuff because my corpsman Dave's fiance was in Hawaii, and I got to look them up, and so I had company that I could talk to and have a good time.
Talk to me about so that's 1966. Do you go back to Vietnam?
No, I've never been back there since I left.
So you didn't have any subsequent deployments back there and or whatnot. Well, tell me about, Joe, in your career, give me a couple highlights from the rest of your career. So you're 3 times wounded Vietnam veteran. You come home. Give me a couple highlights from the rest of your career, because I want to make sure we talk about the fundraising you're doing for the Carolina Marine Museum, and so give me a couple highlights in your career.
Well, when I come back, my EAS was in March of 1968, and this is where my grandmother come in, because I got back, I think, November of 67, somewhere around there. In March of 68, I got my EAS is up. And if you remember, 26 Marines was getting ready to, when I come back to the States, I was 26 Marines at Camp Pendleton. And they were getting ready to go back to Vietnam. I had orders to back to Vietnam on the CO's desk. By that time I was a sergeant. I had a warrant for staff sergeant, and a bonus. And my grandmother talked me out of it. My grandmother said, you've been wounded 3 times. I couldn't bear. If you go back, you may not come home again. Wow. And she probably was right. She probably was right with knowing what the history of what happened in the early 68
right.
time frame in our Corps, in the units that went back over there. I may not have come home. So I got out and stayed in the reserves. I stayed and went to Syracuse, New York, in a tank unit. And in 1970, I got completely out of the Corps, as a staff sergeant, and worked 2 jobs and trying to keep my head above water as a civilian, and that wasn't working. And I was missing the Marine Corps really bad anyway. I wanted back in the Corps. So in 1974, I went to see a recruiter. And said, look, I would like to come back and join the Marine Corps. And it took me a while. Tried to come back in as an NCO. No. Finally, I got a letter from Headquarters Marine Corps in September of 1974, that if I wanted to come back in the Marine Corps, I could come back in the Marine Corps as a PFC. So, I come back in the Marine Corps in October. The 1st of October in 1974 at the PFC.
Motivator.
Yep. And of course, when I checked in, I had no uniforms. I got my uniforms and my wife sewed on PFC Chevron and a hash mark. and I got to the exchange. I got to the exchange and got my ribbons and got all that stuff. So I was automatically a bird because everybody see me in uniform with one hash mark and a PFC Chevron and a chest full of ribbons. You know, obviously I've been court-martialed.
Something.
Everything. I checked in to Bravo Company 1-2, and my company commander at the time seen some potential in me. I made meritorious corporal and meritorious sergeant. So I was a sergeant within about 6 months, 7 months. I was a sergeant. I had company commanders, people like General Labuti, Iron Mike Wittens, Roger McGillrath. They were all my company commanders in Bravo and in 1-2. And anyway, I got my GED in that deployment. It was a real highlight. And then when I come off of that deployment, I was this is 1975. I had orders to Okinawa, and I was the staff sergeant list come out, and I was a staff sergeant. From 74 to 76, I went from PFC to staff sergeant.
Wow.
From there, I went to Parris Island. Got to Parris Island in 76, 77, 1980. I made meritorious gunny at Parris Island. And got orders to the Royal Marines, which was a really, really highlight of my career. To train the Royal Marines in recruit training as a gunny. And I had a troop officer's job at Limston. I worked for Colonel Beverly, who later became the Commandant General of the Royal Marines.
Is it Nick Beverly? It sounds like I know that name from someplace.
It is, yeah. But he ended up becoming the Commandant General of the Royal Marines later on. But yes, he was. I worked for him over there. I ended up getting a medal, a Queen's Medal. I saved a Royal Marine's life and got an accreditation while I was there. What a time! I had a officer's job. It was fabulous. I mean, I really got to do a lot of traveling, got to meet a lot of wonderful people. General Livingston, the Medal of Honor recipient, was the attaché Europe, and he was in London. The Falkland Islands kicked up, and he called me and he said, "Don't forget, you can't go. You cannot go, Gunny." Colonel Beverly, they spoke to him because they were very good friends. And Colonel Beverly told him, said, "Hey, this gun we got down here, his troop is in line for replacements. So if they need replacements for the Falkland Island, if battle went on, then his troop is going to be sent." And he's telling me he wants to go. And I told Colonel Livingston, "Sir, I have trained these guys. These are my guys. These are my Marines. If they go, I'm leading them." And of course, that wouldn't happen because that would have been an international incident, you know, nothing better. But I wanted, you know, it never happened. But I mean, the thought was there. So that was a real highlight. That was a highlight.
Talk to me. So what year do you retire?
I retired in 2000. When I came back from there, I went to 3-6, got promoted to sergeant, and then in 1989, I got promoted to sergeant major. I was a sergeant major in Marine Forces Panama during Just Cause. I got back from there and went to Maintenance Battalion.
Hold on, okay, so during Just Cause, give me one thing about Just Cause that people don't know.
That we had one Marine killed there by a sniper during Just Cause. He was an LAR gunner or a driver that was killed during Just Cause. People don't know that for the longest time, while we were in Panama, we could see Noriega, but we couldn't touch him.
Oh, really? You could see him?
Yeah. Well, I mean, he would be up to our post within 20 feet of one of our posts, and we couldn't touch him for the longest time down in Panama. So, but when I come back from there, I ended up going to the 2nd FFSG, took 2nd Maintenance Battalion to Desert Storm. I had the largest battalion. And during Desert Storm, we fixed everything but aircraft. 1,800 Marines and corpsmen in battalion. Come back. General Krulak, while we were there, General Krulak told me that that I needed a stint in Headquarters Marine Corps. And I told him I really didn't need to go to Headquarters Marine Corps unless I was the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps. And he said, trust me, you do. So I ended up becoming the Sergeant Major of Enlisted Assignments and Retention up there in the early 90s, which was a very, very, I learned more about myself in the Marine Corps being there that helped me later on, because I was one of the first Sergeant Majors that left that job and went back to the fleet.
Most people don't go back.
They retire out of there.
They don't go back with all that knowledge.
That's right. I had an F-18 squadron. I had a Marine Corps Air Station New River, Marine Corps base. And then when I retired, General Peter Pace was my boss as a 3-star at Marine Forces Atlanta. I was his sergeant major. So that's when I retired in 1980. Yep.
All right. So how long have you been been working for the Marine Corps League now?
I've been doing ever since 2000. When I retired, Jim Bracken and General Olmsted, Lieutenant General Olmsted, while I was at the base Sergeant Major at Lejeune and the New River, whenever the expos come in, I was always interested in helping them get people, bodies, blah, blah, blah. And they said, hey, won't you come to work and be our company gunny, if you will, get people to the show and help us get set up, tear down, and stuff. So ever since 2000, I have been bird dogging the shows on the whole three shows, the West, the East, and the one at Quantico.
Got it. I had a really good question I was going to ask you, and I just forgot it. Talk to me about the Museum of the Marine. How did you get involved in it? Where did the idea come from? And make us smart about the Museum of the Marine.
The idea comes from General Etul Ray Smith's wife, Miss Colleen. I was his Sergeant Major when he had the base at Camp Lejeune.
Okay.
And we used to get little packages and letters from time to time, and people would say, put this in your museum. And it was people from World War II or Vietnam or whatever. And of course, Camp Lejeune has no museum. And, so she had mentioned it to the general, and then, our mayor at the time, Jones, George Jones, and him talked, said, we need to build him. He said, General, you need to build a museum here in Jacksonville. And, General Smith called me and asked me, I was at Marine Forces. He called me and said, so what are you going to do when you retire, Sergeant Major? And I said, as little as possible. At the time, I owned a 36-foot boat, completely paid for. Checked the bank. You know, I was going to do as least as I could possibly do. Of course, I'd have went nuts if I didn't see that, but that was an idea. But I said, no, no, no. They sent me letters, and finally I give in. Miss Colleen broke me down and said, all right. And I come back and I said, sure, I can sell a museum, but I'll learn. So that's how I got involved with the – and now I'm – this is – when I was in Europe, when I was with the Royal Marines, my wife and my boys, I have two boys. One's a retired master sergeant. The other's a federal law enforcement officer. But when we were in Europe, they would want to go to museums. And I would go in and look around the museum in Paris or where we were, and I would tell the wife, I'll be outside. I'm going out on the street here. career. I mean, I was not interested. Now, like now, when I see a museum, I'm in it forever, trying to figure out what's wrong.
You know what?
Or how I can do it better.
I just had that experience going to the Air and Space Museum or the Aerospace Museum out by Dulles, where they have the Enola Gay and they have this the shuttle Discovery. I don't know what I expected. I didn't expect what I walked in and saw. And holy shit. I unlike you, love museums, and I love looking at history, especially Marine history. You know, it strikes me that, you know, 2nd Marine Division and 2MEF ought to have a museum, right?
They will.
Ought to have a museum. 1st Marine Division and 1MEF, they ought to have a museum, for God's sakes. I mean, there's a ton of history that could be displayed and that's needed to teach the public these days. What is your official capacity now in that effort?
Well, right now, we're going to have, the goal is 40,000 square foot museum. But it's not like we have one of the most beautiful museums in the world at Quantico, which tells our story from 1775 to present.
Right.
But what it don't highlight like it should, like the one ours is going to highlight, is the first that's come out of the Carolinas, the war dogs, Black Marines, the aviation, the amphibious operation, the women Marines during World War II. During World War II, there was 25,000 women Marines in the Carolina. There was an all-woman squadron in Eatonton, North Carolina, that fixed and repaired aircraft for 89 squadrons that went to the Pacific. That story needs to be told, and it's not told. The first wounded warrior barracks is going to be here. So, the museum here is going to, and with the education, the people need to know what's come out of the Carolinas, but not only that, the core values and stuff that we're going to put in this building to tell the story of yesteryear and what Marines have done today. I mean, we have now phase one of the museum is done. We have the largest eagle anchor in the world in a water setting at the Lejeune Memorial Gardens. And that's the Lejeune Memorial Gardens is a Beirut Memorial, a Vietnam Memorial, a 9/11 Memorial, soon to have a Corman Memorial, all going on 27 acres, just outside the gate of Camp Lejeune.
Is that where the museum's going to go?
That's where the museum's going to go. Yes, sir.
That's awesome. So how is? Tell me about fundraising. How can people that are going to listen to this? How can they help?
They can go to our website. We have naming opportunities that they can do. If they want to pay, name the building after them.
There you go.
Memory zones inside the Great Hall, orientation. We do sell bricks. We have online. You can buy a 8x8 brick for $350. Lines or 8 brick for $250. There's stories. There's different gaming opportunities throughout the museum. Like if you really, really would like to get rid of some tax money, you can name the building for $10 million, you know.
Why not? If you got it floating around, or why the hell not?
If you got it, or the Great Hall for $3 million. The Great Hall is going to be awesome because it's going to have, in this piece, we're going to be able to seat 400 people at a sit-down dinner.
Whoa.
For weddings, for Marine Corps birthday celebrations, or somebody's having a seminar or something like that, it's going to be awesome. Yes, sir.
You know, Joe, I'll just tell you this. Someday, in the not-too-distant future, I would love to the vision of you sat through post-traumatic winning, that presentation I did, and I want to talk about that here in a second.
Oh, yes, sir.
And, the plan is as that thing matures is You do it for units throughout the course of the week, morning and the afternoon. In the evening, though,
yep,
two of the nights we'll do it for spouses. On Wednesday night, we'll do an event for the community. And what it's designed to do is to share the wisdom that we have gleaned through our lives as Marines, but a lot of it dealing with the traumatic events. And the wisdom that we've kind of got, and then it would be awesome to have it at a place like that.
That would be. Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And one of the things that's going to be in the galleries, we have three main galleries, is what we call the memory zone. And what the memory zone is going to do is you, I, or anybody can go in this memory zone and sit down and tell your story. Why are you going to service? Your experience in the service, why you got out of the service, the people you met in the service, and then that, I tell everybody, after we take all the four-letter words out of it, that will go on a computer. So when you go into a gallery and something reminds you of Uncle Jim or Grandpa, your dad, and you sit down at this computer and you type in Joseph Hull, and up pops Sergeant Major Joe Hull, and Joe Hull's telling his story when he joined the Marine Corps in 1964 and how he lost three uncles and his career through there, and so the history that the person is going to be able to find out, or college people when they're writing their paper or whatever, and they want to hear about what happened to somebody in Korea or Vietnam or Iraqi freedom. It's going to be there on tape, so they can sit there and listen to them and possibly even have it videotaped. I mean, that's a possibility we don't know yet.
Well, I'll tell you what, you certainly could do it because it doesn't take a whole lot. And if you need somebody to help you, let me know because I have skills. So you're also building it. That's awesome. You're building it also as a place of research. So,
exactly right. Yes, sir.
That's great. The other thing is that those bricks that that are so popular at the Nassar Museum in Quantico.
Oh, they are.
Right?
Yes,
I mean, every time I go there, I can't believe they're putting bricks on top of bricks. They're not really doing that, but that's how many of those there are, and just a place where you, whether it's with your fire team, your battle buddies, you can put your name on something that will last forever. And so that's proved widely popular. You stood up the end of the post-traumatic winning thing I did on Friday of last week, and you said, and you introduced yourself, and you said, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I want to tell you that you've got to talk about it. I just wondered if you would talk about what you said and why you said it, because I think that is the biggest thing. Most people wind up going to therapists, and they really don't need to go to the therapist. They need to talk to a friend, somebody they're close to, and get it out and tell their story. Tell everybody what you said and why you said what you said.
And it's true. And after listening to your presentation, which was absolutely awesome, and you're right on the money of what you said. For years, I come back from Vietnam in 1967. And from 67 to 77, I didn't talk about my experiences in Vietnam. I mean, for them 10 years, I kept everything in. And then I become a drone instructor, and I become a senior drone instructor. And then in trying to teach and getting the Marines to understand leadership and some of the things, I started talking about my experiences in Vietnam, and the more I talked about it, the better I felt, and I started. Not only did there, I would start talking to other people about it, veterans and even family members. My brother was in Vietnam the same time I was. So we got talking about it, and I felt the more I talked about it, the better I felt. And then when I got to be in a leadership position where I could actually do celebrations or graduations and be in front of Marines and tell, because they want to hear war stories. They want to hear what it was like. And the more I talked about it, the better I felt. And right today, I am a better person because I talked about my experiences. Now, my oldest son did 6 tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. He was a company gunny at 3-6. He was also in FAT company. He was there with Black Hawk Down,
right,
Somalia.
Right.
He was over there during the coal incident. He was the senior guy with FAT company there. So, I mean, he was a shooter. I mean, so he's got some garbage in under his belt right now. And he has more than once said, "Dad, I am so glad. I am so glad that that I can sit and talk to you, and that it really helps." And he's got friends that come and talk. And then I'm the senior vice commander of our Purple Heart chapter here in town, and we emphasize at every meeting. We got one tonight, and we've got Purple Heart Marines today that 2 o'clock in the morning will call one of us leaders in the association and say, "Hey, I'm at the Waffle House. You got 5 minutes?" And we'll go talk with them. And if the more they talk about it, the better they're going to feel. It's absolutely wonderful.
Now, you know what? Again, it's really interesting. And the more research I do, and the more I study and listen and pay attention to other people, I would tell you that 99% of the people that go see therapists that are Marines don't need to go there. They need to talk to another Marine who's had a similar experience. And
you know, and
do exactly what you do for your son, what you do for other Marines. And if you do that, you help people unburden themselves and in a lot of different ways. You save their life. And again, it's nothing abnormal. Right, it's normal to talk. You need to talk about it, especially those kind of experiences, as you try to process it throughout the course of your life. And throughout the course of your life, it changes the way you look at stuff as your life changes. So, I just wanted to thank you for what you said on Friday, and thank you for coming, and thank you for doing this today, Joe. Just so everybody knows,
anytime. And I got a real quick story when the war first started. Way back in the early 2000s, when this war first started, me and another commander, another Purple Heart, John Holmes and stuff, we would go when we heard that we had a Marine at the hospital here at Luzerne. We would leave and go up and visit that Marine. And we walked into a room one afternoon, and we just stood there by the door because the nurse was in there talking to him. And what she said to him took me off so bad that I started screaming in the room, because what she was telling that Marine that lay there with a bullet hole in his leg and one on his arm, nothing was really life threatening, but they still hurt like the devil because he had 2 bullet holes in him.
Right.
"Oh, I know what you're going through. It's going to be okay. I know what you're going through." And I said, and I hollered at her, "Stop! Who the hell do you think you are telling that Marine you know what he's going through? You have no idea." And she ran out, scared the living daylights out of her. She ran out of the room pretty quick. A doctor come in. And "What's going on here?" I told him. I said, "The worst thing that you can have your nurses and your people telling these guys that you know what they're going through, because you have no dang idea."
I'm glad you cleaned that up.
"What they're going through." "Yes, sir."
You know who I heard say that when General Kelly's son was killed. He stood up to speak and he said, "You know,
yep.
I'm no stranger to this." He said, "Okay. I've written letters and I've spoken to parents, and in those letters, you know, I told them that I had 3 children and I understood what they felt." And he said, "And today, as I stand here, I want to apologize to everybody I ever said that to, because I had no idea what you were going through, and I want to apologize for ever saying anything like that to you."
Yes, sir.
It's important that they hear that. And when you, Joe, it makes you angry when people who don't know what you've been through say that?
Yes, sir. Yep. It hit a nerve.
A little bit.
All right.
Now, if you're listening to this, if you click on this link, and it'll take you to the All Marine Radio website and this podcast, in there, there's two links. There's the link for the Carolina Museum of the Marine that'll take you to that. There's also a link to donate. All right. So you can check out the museum and you can find the donate button either on that website or you can find it in this podcast. So, Joe, I hope that, in the future you don't mind if I bug you and drag you back on, whether we talk about leadership.
Please do. I look forward to it.
Vietnam or whatever. Anyway. All right, sir.
Go ahead, sir.
No, I was done. You were going to say something.
No, I just appreciate what you do every day, and I appreciate the opportunity. And anytime you call, I'm available. I'm there. And if you need me to do whatever, I'll be more than happy to do it, sir.
All right, except for yesterday when you stiffed me.
I know. And that wasn't on purpose.
All right. Joe, first of all, it was a pleasure to meet you, an honor to have met you last week. Keep up the great work you do for both the Marine Corps League, because they need guys like you. They need more guys like you. And also all the best of luck on the Carolina Museum of the Marine. And when you get ready to cut that ribbon, I want to come back and do the show from there that day. I'll do the show there that week if you'll have me.
And we'll love
to blow that thing up.
Yeah, all right, sir. Semper Fi.
All right, thanks, Joe. Have a good one.
Yes, sir.
That is Sergeant Major Joe Houle. Houle. Pretty interesting. All right, we're going to take a break. Mike Musselman's set to join us as we continue here on a Tuesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on All Marine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it, the McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on All Marine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the Read Board page at allmarineradio.com.
To be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is that you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue, but it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.